This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with the Bay Area Guy. Bay Area Guy, great having you back on.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me on again.
And I'm also joined by my co-host, Rabbit. Rabbit, great having you on, too.
Yeah, it's great to be back on again.
So we're going to be discussing, to start off with, Bay Area Guy has this article that was published on the blog Alternative Right, called The Alternative Right, Economics and an Alternative Theory of White Disunity. And before I kind of get to that, as this ties in, Rabbit had this kind of manifesto called The Alt-Left as an Alternative to the Alt-Right. But there are definitely like a lot of similarities to what Rabbit wrote about and to a lot of the things that Bay Area Guy has covered in a lot of his articles. Bay Area Guy, are you familiar with Rabbit's article on the alt-left? I know you are familiar with that theory, that kind of a concept in general via Robert Lindsay.
Well, actually, now that you mention it, I have heard of Rabbit, and I actually was first introduced to some of his work via Robert Lindsay, and I haven't read that specific article you mentioned, but I am somewhat familiar with the tenets of alternative left thought, courtesy of Robert, so I kind of have the basics down, you could say.
And Rabbit, you kind of said something similar to what we discussed. I discussed this on a show with Bay Area Guy. Remember, Rabbit, you said something like the alternative left exists kind of in the space occupied in between Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the alternative of left would be something like if it would be all of Ralph Nader's ideas, but if he was more of a race realist and a little bit had like an HBD component to him, which he, you know, or some kind of something like that. Whereas, you know, Buchanan has a lot of similar ideas, but he's of course extremely socially conservative and very religious, you know, so that's kind of the, some sort of like hybrid of the two of them seems to be where it would be at.
And as far as their economic views, whose economic views do you prefer? Obviously, there's a lot of issues where their economic views overlap, trade being probably one of the major ones. And you see the same with Trump and Sanders, too.
Yeah, I would probably agree more with a lot of Nader's views. I think that, you know, Buchanan is right there on trade and some of the populist stuff. But I think that people like Sanders and Ralph Nader and stuff, they promote more of a, you know, all-encompassing European style of, you know, leftist economics, which isn't just, you know, Buchanan is kind of, it's limited to like a couple of different areas. So I would say definitely more of on the Ralph Nader side of economics.
Well, I think in other words, what you're basically saying is that when it comes to economics, people like Buchanan and nowadays Trump, they're populist, economically speaking, when it comes to nationalistic sentiment. They're angry that China's taking jobs. They don't want to, you know, enact all these disastrous free trade deals that enrich your competitors. But at the same time, when it comes to economic justice at home, you don't quite know where they stand in that regard.
Bay Area Guy, can you talk kind of about how your economic views evolved? Did you start off more kind of left-wing economically, or did your views sort of gradually change? Were you at one point more conservative or libertarian?
Well, I was. I can proudly say that I've never been a libertarian, that's for sure. But I will say that I kind of started off more as a centrist. I didn't like the excesses of the Reagan Revolution, the Bush era, but at the same time, I thought that we just need to tweak a few things here and there, you know, have more progressive taxation and redistribute just a little more and we'll be fine. But ever since then, I've been doing more reading on economics, and on the one hand, it sort of made me more inclined to espouse socialist views on economics, but at the same time, my studies have also led me to conclude that there's nothing inherently destructive or rapacious about capitalism, in that our current economic woes say more about the American way than capitalism by itself.
There, a guy a while back, Dota wrote an article called National Capitalism, and I interviewed mm-hmm. him about that. What are your thoughts on the sort of a concept of national capitalism?
Well, if I recall correctly, Dota in his article basically said that capitalism, unless tempered by a sense of nationalism, a sense of obligation, can become quite destructive, because capitalism ultimately requires trust and cooperation. If it's just every man out for himself, everyone out to enrich themselves and seek more and more profit, and when people just disregard their surrounding communities and their nations, then capitalism can become very toxic. And capitalism sort of requires an ethos of sacrifice, this notion that we're all on the same team. And Dota sort of contrasted sort of the high-trust business culture of Japan with the increasingly low-trust, sort of aggressive business culture of the U.S. For example, the American companies will often bully their suppliers into submission, whereas in Japan, there's this idea that we all sink or swim together, and so there's a greater spirit of cooperation.
And that's exactly true. I mean, even though, in a sense, in some of Japan is a hyper competitive environment and they strive to be successful, at the same time, they have this spirit that basically we're all in this together. And in America, is hyper-competitive, but more in a sort of radical individualist sense, where one person thrives at the expense of others. And I think that is the key difference between sort of national capitalism and the sort of a neoliberalism that we have in the United States.
Right. There's a profound sense of anomie in the U.S., that's for sure.
I think there's another component, too, that he kind of alluded to, and that is, that now, because of technology and globalism, et cetera, there's a if capitalism isn't tempered by nationalism or isn't reined in within the context of what's in the national interest, you have these situations where these companies have offices all over the world, and, you know, that's going to affect our policies toward these other countries, because these companies have these dual loyalties. You know, the you know, when a company has a bunch of factories in China, you know, they're going to, if our government is in conflict with these other countries, you know, the companies aren't necessarily going to be on our side. They're going to be like lobbying the government to, you know, on behalf of China's side, because they don't want anything to happen to their factories that are over there and so forth. So they develop this kind of dual loyalty. That's they're no longer loyal to the nation. They become, in a sense, when they become large enough, they become their own entities. And I think that that's kind of dangerous or a disintegrating force to it's like when a lot of people talk about, you know, these American companies, or Apple, in what sense are they really American companies anymore? They're their own transnational entities. They're their own thing. They pay taxes in other countries. You know, it's in only a token sense are they really American.
Well, there's something I'd like to add on to Rabbit's point as well. And speaking of corporate loyalties, one of the reasons why I initially started to like Ralph Nader is because I read an excellent article of his called How About Some Corporate Patriotism for a Change? And Nader, as Nader points out, and as Ha-Jun Chang, one of the authors I reviewed for in my recent article, points out, despite the fact that these corporations are transnational, capital still has a nationality. So they may pay taxes in other countries, they may offshore, but the bulk of their research and development and the home of their operations is still in their host country, and they also benefit from residing in these first world countries where they can have access to first world middle class consumers. So they basically owe their wealth and their prestige to being American companies, and yet they completely spit on their host nation by, further enriching themselves at the expense of their fellow citizens.
Do you think at some point that they could basically still thrive without the American consumers? And basically, let's say if America becomes obsolete as a country, these multinational corporations can continue to thrive globally? Or do you think they need the United States to thrive?
I just feel like at some point something has to give, because basically our consumer model relies on a large number of people having access to disposable income. And in China, of course, workers get paid hardly anything, and that's why they offshore there in the first place. And increasingly in the U.S., more and more people are living paycheck to paycheck, and they don't have the kind of disposable income to purchase these goods like they did before. So eventually what you're going to have is you're going to have a lot of production, but not enough people with enough money to spend money on what's being produced. So at some point, I think the joke's going to be on the big corporations.
That was basically the philosophy of Henry Ford. And Henry Ford's kind of an example of what Dodo was talking about, national capitalism. He basically, his philosophy was to pay his workers a decent wage so they would have money to buy his products.
Oh, exactly.
So in your article on alternative right, you basically start off making the point that your critique of the alternative right is that that movement in general doesn't focus enough on economic issues, considering that basically, well, they have the issues that they care the most about, which are mass immigration and cultural erosion and cultural changes. But your point is that because corporate interests are the primary driving force, it's absolutely necessary to focus on economics, but also look into a lot of sort of economic thinkers who might be perceived as a left-leaning to demolish the sort of neoliberal dichotomy.
Right, and ultimately neoliberalism is the enemy of all people, left-wing and right-wing. And I think the reason why I felt compelled to write that article is because, one, I feel like a lot of people on the alternative right do not really know how to assign blame for what's taking place. And I sort of wanted to challenge these myths. But also, I wrote the article because, like I said near the end, I think there's a tremendous amount of potential for the alternative right to grow if they address economic issues more forcefully, because one only has to look at the popularity of Bernie Sanders among white millennials such as myself. And one also has to only observe Donald Trump and how, in addition to his aggressive rhetoric, he has also galvanized people on account of his intense opposition to free trade. And he's one of the very few politicians, Democrat or Republican, who's vocally opposing these neoliberal arrangements.
Proven that that message really sells. I know that the powers that be are really going to try to sabotage him. But one of his advantages is he has the ability to pull in a lot of working class Democrats in states like Ohio, and that could, if he's successful with that, that will completely change the whole sort of political dichotomy.
Well, the way I see it, regardless of how the election transpires, the forces unleashed by Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are not going away anytime soon, and both the Democratic and Republican parties will be irrevocably changed. And regarding the general election, it's interesting because even though the media likes to demonize Trump as some fascist demagogue, on certain issues such as trade, foreign policy, and war, he's actually more progressive than Hillary Clinton. And in certain states such as the aforementioned Ohio, he could actually run to her left on trade and win over these white working class types. And as I stated in my article, I think that there is potential for certain Sanders supporters to cross over, because I think at the end of the day, a lot of the white guys who are voting for Bernie Sanders do so for economic reasons. They're not interested in all that social justice, feminism stuff.
I think the core of Bernie Sanders' message is the economic issues, the income inequality, but there definitely is a sort of a social justice warrior element as well. I also think they've been putting a lot of pressure on him. I know if you watched the last Democratic debate, The moderator of who I think was Jorge Ramos from Univision was really grilling Bernie Sanders because he voted on some issues. He voted with immigration restrictionist, and they've really put pressure on him to sort of cave in on that issue. So I think they're really putting a lot of pressure on him, but there is that element of his supporters. But overall, the key issue driving the whole Bernie Sanders movement is you have all these young people who have massive student loan debt and they can't find jobs and they're being totally economically decimated.
Well, of course. And I'm also glad you mentioned the pressure that they've been putting on him, because I wrote an article about a year ago about that one writer for Vox named Dylan Matthews, who wrote about an interview Sanders had with Ezra Klein, where Sanders basically opposed open borders, saying, no way, that's a Koch brothers policy. They want to flood the country with cheap labor, pay them $3 an hour. And then he was attacked for his ugly and wrongheaded views on immigration. And one more interesting thing about this election is that a lot of these social justice warrior types, these supposed radicals, they're basically circling wagons around Hillary Clinton and doing so with social justice rhetoric. You know, people like Amanda Marcotte, Jameel Smith, all these other boutique identitarian liberals, they're basically defending the establishment candidate, but because she's a woman, well, suddenly it's progressive. So it's been fascinating to watch that play out.
What do you think about Bernie's recent comment where he said that white people don't understand what it's like to be in poverty?
Oh, that. Well, yeah, that did sort of make me cringe a bit. And I think that was sort of a very unfortunate moment. And the reason I think why he did it is, I would hope he doesn't believe that deep down, but he has been getting grilled on race. And if you've been following the primaries, he's been losing quite badly to Hillary Clinton in states with heavy black populations. So I feel like he's trying to sort of pander to black voters more as he leaps the South and sort of try to chip away at Hillary Clinton's so-called firewall.
In your article, you do reference this blogger from the conservative nanny state named Dean Baker. And mm-hmm. He talks about the whole sort of a concept that the jobs Americans won't do. And basically what he says is that the sort of the folklore in immigration is that immigrants take jobs that workers in the United States do not want to do. And you get into that and you sort of tie it back into this whole theme of economics and having forces behind a lot of these issues.
Right. And what's interesting is that you also have to analyze the flip side of the equation, because whenever working class white people see their livelihoods destroyed on account of immigration and outsourcing, the usual knee-jerk mainstream liberal, and for that matter, conservative responses, oh, stop whining, work harder. Or I remember South Park had that one episode where they mocked working class white types with the whole, they took our jobs clip. But what Baker points out is that even while lower class whites are subjected to competition, highly paid professionals such as doctors, economists, lawyers, etc., are mostly shielded from it. And if you think about it, there are around 7 billion people in the world, and there's certainly no shortage of bright, energetic, hustling individuals from those countries who could do excellent work as doctors, economists, and lawyers for much cheaper prices than what our current doctors, economists, and lawyers are getting paid. And yet you don't see that happen. Even during an era of supposed free trade, licensing rules for foreign doctors are being tightened. And so you really, in many ways, it's sort of good to think of immigration and trade policy as class warfare.
I think traditionally that has been the case, where it was like the working class that was being dispossessed. Bay Area guy, where you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, what is the situation like with like upper middle class whites? Are they being displaced as well?
Well, not the upper middle class types, but what's interesting is in San Francisco, you currently have this sort of Hobbesian competition for space, because all these tech workers from Silicon Valley are sort of flowing into the city. And you'd think that according to the logic of these pro-open borders types, this would be a great thing. They're bringing jobs, they're bringing growth, they're bringing prosperity. And yet that's not what people are, people are not buying that at all. They're actually rather angry about the current situation. They see these tech workers as driving up cost of living, increasing traffic, and also squeezing out poorer, disproportionately Latino residents in neighborhoods such as the Mission. So it's kind of funny because even though a lot of people extol the virtues of open borders when it comes to lower skilled immigrants moving into majority white countries, when disproportionately white and Asian tech workers flood into San Francisco, then suddenly they're destroying the culture and they're displacing people. So there's a bit of a disconnect here.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add is I think that it started out with a lot of the unskilled workers, but I think we're seeing more and more that it isn't just unskilled workers. It's actually going to be it's at every level. You know, they're finding out that they can get cheaper people or importing people.
So a lot of those workers, like the tech visas, a lot of them end up becoming very wealthy themselves. So these are not all, not people coming in are not necessarily all like poor people,
right,
which is a stereotype. You also have a lot of wealthy multimillionaires from China with a lot of real estate. So
it's not
so much about
immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft has an Indian CEO. You know, like jobs Americans won't do, you know, like CEO of Microsoft, you know, there's, and then, you know, my city, at least if I look through the book, I see tons of Indian doctors. Of course, I think a doctor is a little bit different because, you know, when I think of someone from India, I think like, yeah, I don't want this guy operating on me. You know, who knows where he went to school? Like everybody else, I look for like the most Jewish sounding name in the book when I'm looking for like a GI doctor or something. I think that you do see that more and more and more, and it's almost kind of it's one of these things where these people that were advocating this, now their jobs are starting to be threatened. You know, that's when you see, like, my company has, I see more and more of these Indian programmers coming in. We have more and more of them every week. And it's kind of funny, we always joke because there's a new, like, company email that comes in every week with, like, the new hires. And more, it's just there's so many of these. There's more and more Indians on these, and they kind of have them where they're situated in weird spots in the building. And I always joke that, yeah, that's so like when clients come here that it doesn't look like they have outsourced everything, you know, for these potential clients to visit the building. And plus, they've got them stashed away in these corners, in these little
rooms
and areas.
One of the trends I've noticed is that sort of the stereotypical sort of right-wing populist movement sort of historically attracted people like basically that were viewed as like rednecks, but I've noticed a growing number of like what people who are well-educated, even from like upper middle class backgrounds, joining dissident movements. And I think part of the reason that is because a lot of the kids of the upper middle class, even they are seeing a decline in their opportunities. So you could
right.
see, like, the children of, say, upper-middle-class liberals become political dissidents as they get older, as their opportunities dramatically decline.
Well, what's interesting about this election is even though a significant bulk of Donald Trump's supporters are these working-class, lower-class whites, there have also been people with postgraduate degrees in states such as Massachusetts who have voted for Trump. And you also have to, one other thing to keep in mind is that back when the Tea Party was all the rage, the media tried to depict them as a bunch of uneducated redneck buffoons who just hate the idea of a black president. And yet when you actually looked at the profile of your average Tea Partier, they were better educated and more affluent than the majority of the population. So
the thing about the Tea Party is they weren't as populist. There was a segment of people involved in the Tea Party who were primarily people who did have some degree of wealth, and their primary concern was taxation. And I mean, that's a legitimate concern for a lot of people. I'm not dismissing that. But a lot of those people were people who already had wealth. I'm talking about more of a growing number of people who are being economically decimated, who in the past would have been people who would have been joining the upper middle class.
Right. That's a good point. And I guess I should make a distinction, and I'm definitely not saying that the Tea Party was genuinely populist, and I don't think very much of the Tea Party at all, but they did channel that populist rhetoric. And I think that the media often wants to sort of shut their eyes and say, oh, it's just a bunch of ignorant rednecks. They just need to educate themselves and become enlightened, and they don't really want to see the anger brewing.
And back to this article on the same point, you also talked about this article where Ha-Jun Chang says that if there was free migration, most workers in rich countries could be and would be replaced by workers from poor countries. And basically, those wages are largely politically determined.
Well, exactly, because there are hundreds of millions of English speakers all over the world in places like India, elsewhere, who could easily do the jobs that many professional Americans do at much lower wages. And ultimately, neoliberalism, globalization, it's a big race to the bottom, and ultimately it comes for everyone. So I think that ultimately we need to slay this neoliberal hydra before it infects us all.
You were also saying that you said that because Chang is from he's from China, he sort of understands the dynamics of these issues because he's able to sort of observe the economies of both countries and contrast them.
Well, he's actually from South Korea, but yeah, I guess the Chang kind of makes it you think he's Chinese, but he actually. Well, the thing is that East Asians at their core are a nationalistic, collectivist people, and they think of their group and their nation first. So when they approach disciplines like economics, they're not going to be as pro-free market or as radically individualistic, because unlike nations such as the U.S. and Britain, which have been wealthy for longer periods of time, the wealth of East Asia is more recent, and the way East Asian nations have acquired their wealth is through heavy-handed protectionism, subsidies for certain key industries, and significant immigration restrictions. So I think it'll be hard-pressed to find too many East Asians who embrace radical free market libertarian-style economics.
Oh, you say that Bay Area yuppies enjoy this access to the cheap maize and gardeners, but the interest of basically the white masses must be sacrificed.
Right, and ultimately, I feel like one of the problems with the U.S. is that it has an addiction to cheap labor. And so when you hear a lot of these Bay Area liberals, you know, wax indignant about xenophobia and how, you know, we need to let immigrants in and stop the hate, well, yeah, there might be some fruity liberalism involved, but I think there's also some economic interest. You know, I've known people in the Bay Area who hire Mexican maids, and they want to continue to have access to that cheap labor. So they don't want the status quo to be altered in any way because they're affluent Bay Area denizens. They have no reason to shake things up and close the borders.
Oh, then you also go on to say that you said that Bay Area liberals make no effort to conceal their disdain for white trash and other whites who aren't successful or enlightened like them, but you've also known rich, narcissistic, white Orange County Republicans who basically are the same. The differences are superficial between those two groups.
Well, I don't want to go full Marxist and reduce everything to class analysis, but one thing I will say is that rich whites tend to have more in common with each other, regardless of how liberal or conservative they are, than they do with other people. For example, just take the, I'll get back to the whole Bay Area, Orange County thing in a second, but just look at Haim Saban or Sheldon Adelson, for example. One's a major Democratic donor, another's a major Republican donor, yet they're both billionaires and they both support similar policies. So ultimately, elites of all stripes do not really want to rock the boat. And going back to the Bay Area yuppies and the Orange County Republican types, I actually know someone from Orange County who is mostly a Republican, but he actually told me in a recent conversation that if Trump's the nominee, he'll vote for Hillary Clinton. And honestly, it didn't surprise me because he's sort of an affluent, easygoing Orange County Republican, and his conservatism mostly entails the usual conservatism classic stuff, lower taxes, you know, pro-business, etc. And I guess it just goes to show you that the differences between the Democrats and Republicans are not that significant if he feels like Hillary Clinton is a safe choice.
That's interesting because historically Orange County has actually promoted a lot of the sort of California's Republican immigration hardliners, like someone like, I guess, like the former congressman, Bob Dornan. There was Duncan Hunter from San Diego, Dana Rohrabacher, like a lot of those types who came out of Southern California, especially Orange County.
Well, what's interesting is in his book Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser mentioned that during the late 80s or early 90s, I forget exactly when, there was actually a mass exodus of these conservative white Californians to various mountain states such as Colorado, and that SoCal lost a lot of its conservative white population, whereas the mountain states, thanks to this new influx, became much more conservative. And there were even signs in places like Colorado saying, don't Californicate us. So that might be a factor as well.
Rabbit, do you meet a lot of California transplants where you are in Arizona?
Yeah, I do. There's transplants that come from all over here. And one thing that is interesting is that they always come here for some kind of opportunity or, you know, to get away from something else. But as soon as they get here, they want to vote for something to make the place like wherever they came from. You know, a good example of this would be public transportation. You know, these people left from all these other places, and you know, Phoenix was notorious for just having almost no public transportation. But then you had all these people coming from Chicago and the East Coast, you know, came out here for jobs or for cheap houses and whatnot, and then they get here and then they want to do all of these big public projects that are, you know, they left these other cities because of the property taxes and the state taxes, that all these taxes were so high, and then they want to implement the same things here, which lead to that. Now, I'm, of course, you know, not that opposed to a lot of those types of policies, but it just shows, I think that it's when you brought up Southern California, it reminds me of I've watched a lot of old videos on YouTube of like a lot of late 80s, early 90s, kind of like white nationalist stuff, you know, like those old cable access shows like Metzger, Race and Reason.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
Wally George's show?
Yeah, exactly. Wally George, Rebecca De Mornay's dad. The I mean, those, when you watch those shows now, it's like you can see that that they went through all these battles back then, and that the immigration restriction is you know, they completely lost, and now we're kind of fighting those nationally. If you go back and watch those cable access shows, you can see that they're fighting about a lot of the same stuff that we are now. It's kind of so when you talk about Southern California now, I think that that battle's basically over, and that the demographics have gone so far there, and you know, those voices are basically gone. Those battles
right.
are being fought on other front lines now. The lines have moved.
Mm-hmm. And as I say, as California goes, so goes the rest of the nation. And that's why I think if you want to reverse these trends, you have to go about fighting them in a different way, because, as they say, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So that's why I think we need more of an economic analysis. We can't just keep criticizing immigration and multiculturalism using the same tactics that people back in the 80s and 90s did.
Well, I guess a lot of alt-right podcasts, every single other word is like cultural Marxism, but often you never hear the economic angle of things.
Right, and in people's day-to-day lives, they're mostly worried about economic concerns. The majority of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. Health insurance is increasingly a nightmare, and ultimately most people don't really have much time for buzz terms like cultural Marxism. And on the flip side, it's why more and more people are losing patience with social justice warriors. And so that's why I think if you want to bring more people into the fold, you have to speak to them in language that resonates with them.
I see in your article you have this picture of the Bernie Bros, and you say future alt-writers with a question mark.
Well, it was actually the editors who inserted that
okay.
photo, but I think that you might very well see people who migrate over to the right, because if you just look at the ridicule that these so-called Bernie Bros have been subjected to, you've seen all these pieces decrying the whiteness or the maleness of Bernie Sanders supporters, and I think these frustrated white males who support Sanders, after seeing how much the mainstream left despises them, could very well gravitate towards other movements.
And you have this other article on Occident Invicta. You wrote this back in December called, it was a review of Saving Capitalism by Robert Reich. And you read his book, and Robert Reich is an economist. I think was he involved in the Obama administration?
No, he was Bill Clinton's former labor secretary.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Well, the reason why I wrote the book was because it was actually part of my stepfamily's book club that I attend, and since I found the book rather edifying, I decided to write a review on it. And it's sort of kind of similar to what you see in the conservative nanny state and Ha Jun Chang's book, 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. The one thing that Reich lays bare is that a lot of what we take for granted and a lot of what we see as inevitable was not inevitable, and that there is no such thing as a magical free market, and that rules are what prop the market up, and that capitalism is full of these regulations and restrictions that we just take for granted. And so we need to stop being suckered in by all this flowery rhetoric about the free market.
When we're talking about the Bernie Bros, I think that a big part of it is that, you know, these Bernie Sanders supporters and people on the left in general that I talk to, are their perception of the right is completely different. You know, they don't know anything about the alt-right. They don't read Countercurrents or the right stuff. Is like their perception of it is a bunch of hardcore religious people and basically just fat old white men, capitalists and jocks and whatnot. So if that's the framework of their equation, of course they're going to be Bernie Sanders supporters. I think that as the media empire grows of some of these more identitarian alt-right movements, I think that the aesthetics of it is going to appeal more to those people as And I think we're going to see more of a division that's less among ideological lines. It's basically you're going to have a multicultural party and then more of a nationalist party. And you'll have some ethno-masochist whites that are still over there just like, oh, you know, we hate white people, we hate ourselves, we're awful. You're going to have that component, and then you're going to have some that are going to at some point reject that attitude and just be like, you know what, I'm going to go over and have fun with these other guys, you know, because this hating myself thing is bullshit, you know, I'm done
exactly.
with all that.
It was kind of interesting you mentioned that this division, Rabbit, and in many ways you could politics has come to the U.S. You have social democracy as represented by Bernie Sanders, and then you have right-wing nationalism as represented by Trump. And I think if we lived in a European-style parliamentary system, the Democratic and Republican parties would have already split into multiple parties. You'd have the social justice warriors and neoliberal types, ethno-masochists on the one hand, and then you'd have the social democrats as represented by Sanders on the other. And eventually, you're right, there are only so many people who can indulge in ethno-masochism, and most people don't want to go around constantly being harangued and constantly having to apologize. So
it's interesting you bring up European politics, because a lot of the sort of establishment conservatives are trying to attack Donald Trump and saying he's more like a European style nationalist, like say Marine Le Pen, than like a true real American conservative.
Right. And what these clueless mainstream conservatives don't realize is that the mood of the country has changed, and that the majority of white Americans are no longer interested in this, oh, true conservatism, true American values. And just look at the way Trump has jettisoned Republican orthodoxy on various issues such as Social Security, foreign policy, trade deals, and yet so many regular rank-and-file white Republicans still support him. So I think that conservatism's image is definitely going to be radically altered, and the Republican Party will not be the same.
And with Trump, I mean, when he ran, he didn't run, but he flirted with running for president under a Ross Perot's Reform Party. He actually came out in favor of a massive tax increase on the ultra-rich to pay off the deficit. So he's taken more economically maybe left positions in the past. But I do think in order to win the Republican nomination, he does have to sound at least somewhat conservative on economics.
Well, I don't necessarily know about that. It depends on how you define conservative on economics, because the mood in the country today is more populist. And there was actually an article I wrote for Alternative Right called Let Him Eat Islamophobia, an older article from around late December. And I linked to an article written by David Frum in The Atlantic. Now, just so you know, I do not hold David Frum in very high esteem at all, because he's an odious neocon behind the whole axis of evil nonsense. But with that out of the way, he wrote this excellent article where he basically documented the chasm separating the Republican donor class from the base's rank and file. And the donor class wanted to invest everything in candidates like Jeb Bush, who was this conservatism classic type, you know, balanced budgets, cutting taxes, pro-vouchers, etc. And yet, the rank and file brutally rejected him. They wanted nothing to do with Jeb Bush's usual mainstream cliched positions. And so this failure to sort of recognize the increasingly rancorous changing mood of the electorate has sort of created this division in the Republican Party. So I think Trump has sort of demonstrated that all that conservative classic stuff never really meant too much in the end.
And one of the points that you make in your article about Robert Reich's book is that basically the way that we discuss capitalism in American society is fundamentally flawed, because we're presented with this false dichotomy that you basically have free market or government intervention. And Robert Reich basically does And what's interesting about him is Robert Reich is basically someone who's pretty much about as establishment as you can get. As you said, he was part of the Clinton administration, but there's a lot of excellent points in here. He basically says there never really has been a free market in American history because current oligarchs will tout the benefits of free enterprise and competition, will they tamper with the markets to ensure their own monopolies. And you get into this, all these different monopolies, the cable company monopolies, the monopolies in the pharmaceutical companies, and you on and on.
Well, I'm actually glad you brought up the cable companies because speaking of people who tout the benefits of limited government and competition while at the same time acting as nannies for the rich and powerful, take Marco Rubio, or I guess little Marco as Donald Trump has now branded him. He's sort of the classic cliche mainstream conservative type who, you know, lower government, less government, lower taxes, et cetera. And yet, at the behest of cable companies, Marco Rubio, who's obviously funded by them, he supports the right of state governments to ban local municipalities from creating their own cable networks. And so, yeah, despite all his flowery rhetoric about reigning in the government, he's more than happy to support government intervention when it comes to assisting rich and powerful mega corporations.
And if you look at insurance, and nobody's talking about this, this is something that I've been thinking about, but basically the dichotomy in healthcare is either we have the current private health insurance or we have a socialized medicine single payer, or we have Obamacare, which basically Obamacare forces people to buy from private insurance companies. But why don't people just set up their own insurance companies where people pool their resources? And that was basically how insurance was originally intended to work out. Then basically they became these massive for-profit industries where you see insurance company CEOs becoming multi-billionaires. But if people just pooled their resources, they could have affordable health care. And I'm not necessarily saying I'm not opposed to providing free health care for those who can't afford it, but that's something that we people should look into because I've never really heard anyone discuss that on either on other side.
Is it, if you look at banking, it sort of started off the same way. It was this boring profession where local people in the community would pool their resources and start a bank. I mean, think of the Bailey family and It's a Wonderful Life. And it was you would not take big risks because you were mostly investing your own capital into these banks and you were mainly just helping out the local community. But now these banks have become these massive behemoths, and that's sort of the recurring theme in the American economy, just these massive mega corporations, these monopolies. And one other important thing that Reich points out in the book, and which I didn't really get into in the article, is that despite all the rhetoric you hear, especially in Silicon Valley, about being a dynamic entrepreneur and, you know, startups, startup after startup, et cetera, the U.S. has actually become far less entrepreneurial than it used to be. And between the years 1978 and 2011, the rate of business creation has been cut in half. So the U.S. is not very competitive at all anymore in many ways.
So really the economic peak in this country was basically like started 50s and 60s, even into maybe into the 70s. But the point you make, that your take on it, is that basically the Great Depression and World War II created this tremendous sense of solidarity, and that also the devastation. Plus, I think we talked about this in a previous interview, is the government was, well, you had this threat of the Soviets and fascism, and the government was an elite. They were concerned that communist or sort of pseudo-fascist movements could spread to the United States. So to prevent that, like, you had FDR providing like the New Deal and trying to get people to work because FDR was afraid that people would start like a fascist movement during the Great Depression, then during the Cold War, there was concerns that if people were economically disadvantaged, they become communists. So in the 50s, like you had Eisenhower, and into the 60s of JFK, there still was a sense of noblesse oblige where the powers that be realized to stay in power, they had to provide a high quality of life. And then basically what happened, then basically really when that ended was when the Cold War ended towards the end of the Reagan era.
Right, because there was no longer any fear of a communist boogeyman. And also with the Soviet Empire in shambles, the U.S. basically had no barriers to, you know, bringing about globalization. And so they acted accordingly. And that's why I feel like as much as we may pine for the 50s years, that era was an unprecedented accident of history. I mean, World War II had devastated all of the U.S.'s major competitors, whereas the U.S. was left mostly unscathed. And there's no way you can replicate that kind of prosperity. But what we can do is we can still combat neoliberalism and ensure that we can at least make the U.S. not quite as unequal and bring it to the same level as other first world countries.
Rabbit, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, a little bit. I'd say that, when it comes to healthcare, it always kind of irritates me hearing conservatives talk about it in as if it's just like any other form of economics. It really isn't, because it's not the same thing when you're shopping for a car, you know, and you're just like, oh, well, these places can compete, and then I'll look and see who has the best deal. It's like if you need your appendix out or something, you're not going to, like, you know, go on Yelp or something and see, like, you know, who's got the best reviews or something. You just get, or, go through the Yellow Pages and see who's got the best prices, or like, oh, you got to get a coupon code or something. It's you have to go to the hospital or you're going to die, and you have to pay whatever they bill you. I had a very minor outpatient surgery a few years ago, and I was there for like 2 hours getting this minor surgery done, and the hospital billed me $20,000. No one can.
It's ridiculous.
I was there 2 hours, and I was lucky I had insurance, because, you know, so I only had to pay like $3,000 or something with after deductibles and this kind of stuff. And you say, well, you know, you had insurance, or if you didn't have insurance, you could negotiate with them. But it's just like, the reality is they can charge you whatever they want because you need it, or you don't have a choice. So you either get this or you're going to die. Like especially if you need something, if you have cancer or something, cancer treatment, you know, what are you going to say? Like, oh, you know, there's this guy in his garage who said he'll treat me with stuff that's like he'll only charge me $1,500. You know, yay, capital. It's a completely different dynamic, you know. And I understand that there are issues as far as, you know, you're going to have to wait in line. The hospital service is going to be shittier. But just thinking of it in straight libertarian capitalist terms is just it just doesn't fit. It doesn't fit that way.
Right. And what's also even more horrifying when you think about it is that even though a lot of the discourse on healthcare focuses on the plight of the uninsured, I just recently read a statistic that the majority of people, around 3/4, who are suffering from medical bankruptcies are people who actually have insurance. So even if you do have something like Obamacare, and it gives people more access in theory, it still doesn't deal with the deductibles, copay, and other expenses. So it really is quite a mess.
Totally, because it's like when you have, when you have laws and restrictions, the companies always do like as much as they can get away with and be within the law. So you see the these corporations that buy these plans, you know, suddenly they, you know, they send you out an email like, hey, guess what, guys? We're getting a new and better insurance plan for the company. And then you look at it and suddenly, like, you know, your deductible went from, like, a $1,000 deductible to, like, a $4,000 deductible. And you're like, wait a minute, dude, this isn't better. Like, this sucks. You know, my company recently did that within the last year or two, where they got this plan where it's, there's no copays until your deductible. So basically you have to pay 100% until you hit the deductible, and then it's insurance kicks in and starts paying after you pay, like, you know, $2,000 or $3,000. So it's just like, if the government didn't have regulations on this stuff, it would be even worse. They would have all kinds of clauses and things like that in there, that as soon as you got to the doctor, you'd find out, oh, this isn't covered, that's not covered, and I have to pay more. It's only in libertarian theory does this kind of deregulation work out. Because the reality is they can bury you in paperwork, so you won't even be able to know if you're getting a good deal or not. And nobody has the kind of time to get a lawyer and
Right. Sort
through all this stuff.
And I'm actually glad you mentioned that, because I used to work at a startup where I basically did data entry, basically looking at the various questions and claims by employees of different companies. You know, is this covered under this plan? If I move out of network, how much do I have to pay? And can I add a dependent? And it's just so complex and confusing that even I didn't really know what was going on a lot of the time. So you can only imagine that most regular people don't understand just how complex the healthcare system is. Regarding libertarians, you're absolutely right, because if you go back in time to, say, the early 20th century, these same libertarians would have been saying, oh, don't abolish child labor laws, don't introduce food and drug safety, it will disrupt the market, and, you know, we just need to deregulate everything because the people who do act honorably will be favored by consumers, and similar nonsense. And you're right. It's really, really never been, it's fantasy, because I actually once had a debate with a libertarian friend of mine, and I sort of challenged him and said, okay, look, if libertarianism is so great, name me one successful libertarian country, either today or in the history of the world. And the best he could say was the 19th century United States, which was hardly libertarian, so it's lunacy.
Well, the thing is, there's never really been any ideologically pure country. There's never really been ideologically pure socialism or ideologically pure conservatism. But you're saying, I mean, the only example of libertarianism, I guess, would be a place where extremely, like, sparsely populated environments. I guess the Old West would have been kind of the closest example you could give. But those were places where there are very few people. Basically, the more people
Right.
you have in a society, the more need for regulations there are. Libertarianism would not really work in today's society. Are there some libertarian ideas or policies that you agree with?
Well, at least for me, I would be a little less hostile towards libertarianism if they focused more on the liberty part of libertarianism, civil liberties, you know, anti-NSA surveillance, stuff along those lines. If they focused more on that and less on wanting to privatize everything, I might just be open to some of their suggestions. But asking them to not be these Milton Friedman, Ayn Rand acolytes who want to privatize everything is sort of like expecting feminists not to care about rape culture, so not going to happen.
We're basically pretty much towards the end of the show, but I think that one of the keys is people complain a lot about economic problems, and also writing more about economic solutions as well, and really getting people to think about these issues.
Right, and I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, even if somehow Bernie Sanders did get elected, that he would suddenly introduce these sweeping changes and radically improve people's day-to-day lives. But I do think what is important is that we change the conversation around economics, and we sort of dismantle all these pretty lies about the free market and American capitalism, and we sort of force these issues out into the open, and so that way we can more easily come up with proper solutions.
And Rabbit, was that one of the key issues that inspired you to kind of start up with the alternative right? I mean, the alternative left.
He kind of hits on it a little bit, and that is that a lot of the alt-right you can see is basically what I call like a GOP plus, which is, it's like they've become edgier on racial issues and sex issues, but they still need to go in and examine all of the other basically the sacred commandments of conservatism, because there's a lot more to re-examine there when you're going to form something new. There's a lot of other things in there that actually, as Bay Area guy says, the economic incentives are a huge driving force of the racial component, the immigration and a lot of the cultural stuff, that you see.
Do you think economics plays a role with the migrant crisis in Europe? Because I've been thinking about this, because if things get so chaotic, wouldn't that wreck some of those countries' economies? And wouldn't that be bad for business interest?
Well, I think that they're not necessarily foreseeing the breaking point, because I've seen articles, and I've posted links to these on my site, that are these business articles that are saying how the refugees could be an economic boom for Europe, because they're looking at these people. They're looking at everything in terms of an economic unit, of a coin. And so I think that he touched on this earlier, but a lot of these people they're shielded from it. You can even see this in the American election. You see that the states that Cruz is winning are the states that are white and completely isolated from the social impact.
Well, that isn't entirely true, because Cruz won Texas, and Texas is extremely diverse.
Well, I mean, that's his home state, so you'd hope he'd win that one. But regarding the refugee crisis, what's kind of interesting is that, one, you're absolutely right, Rabbit. They just see them as economic units. As Doda pointed out in his article, National Capitalism, whereas we see nations and people, neoliberals see markets and a labor pool.
Well, the thing is, a lot of these refugees, a lot of them are totally unemployable. I mean, you see them, like, they're defecating in the streets. They're obviously a big burden in terms of like sexual harassment laws. So these people are unemployable. What benefit are they? I think the corporations are just so greedy. They want as many people in, but I think in the long run, it could end up having a negative effect. Because think about it. I mean, I think a lot of people are going to like cancel their vacations to Europe. People are going to stop visiting the Greek islands. People may even stop visiting cities like visiting Germany as much, and that's going to have a devastating impact on the economy.
Well, I will just say this. I do think that many European elites are cognizant of the threat, because they recently forged an agreement with Turkey where they basically will pay Turkey around 4 billion euros, and in exchange, Turkey will host various refugees. So Europe has sort of reached a deal with Turkey that was similar to what they had with Gaddafi in Libya, where Turkey basically acts as Europe's bouncer that keeps out unwanted refugees. So they are trying to, I think in vain, outsource the problem, but I think that they're at least waking up about this issue.
We are out of time, so I would like to thank Bay Area Guy and Rabbit for being on.
Yes, it was great being on. Great conversation.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we're back with you next time.